Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Each weekend, we review the past week of our VOA Asia program. Among today's stories, worry over the future of the North Korea-U.S. talks.
Heaven help the diplomats that want this to move forward.
And more than surprise as the U.S. president issues an unexpected tweet about a giant Chinese communications company.
This has caught all of those in the export controls and sanctions world, certainly by surprise and with some degree of shock and awe.
That and much more today on VOA Asia Weekend. The White House is taking a wait-and-see approach on whether next month's Singapore summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take place after Pyongyang expressed sharp reservations about U.S. demands that it dismantle its nuclear weapons program. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders met with reporters outside the White House Wednesday.
This is something that we fully expected. The president is very used and ready for tough negotiations. And if they want to meet, we'll be ready. And if they don't, that's okay, too.
We'll continue
with the campaign of maximum pressure if that's the case. But like I just said, if they want to meet, the president will certainly be ready and we will be prepared. But if not, that's okay.
The fate of the summit was thrown into doubt after North Korea First Vice Foreign Minister Kim Kai-kwon said Pyongyang will have to reconsider whether to take part in the summit if the United States continues to demand that the regime unilaterally abandon its nuclear weapons arsenal. Kim said North Korea will not be interested in the Trump-Kim summit if Washington tries to push us unilaterally into a corner and force us to give up nukes. We welcome to VOA Asia Dr. Paul Evans, professor at the University of British Columbia, teaching Asian and Trans-Pacific Affairs. Paul, are you surprised that this has happened?
The specifics of what has transpired in the last 2 days does make me surprised. However, that there were going to be bumps, twists, turns on this peace train on the Korean Peninsula is no surprise. There are major constituencies that do not want these things to move ahead, or at least are uncertain where this train might be moving, and that the twists and turns before we get to the negotiating table, much less what happens afterwards, this is just the first of, I think, many surprises and twists that are going to come our way over the next few months.
Let's get a little specific here. You know that National Security Advisor John Bolton recently talked publicly about the Libyan decision to denuclearize during the Bush administration as a model for U.S. policy on North Korea. The White House has since downplayed those comments a bit after a North Korean official said Bolton's remarks were indicative of an awfully sinister move to imperil the Kim regime. Is that one of the motivating factors, as you see it?
There are a number of players, both, I suspect, on the North Korean side, but certainly in the United States, who have varied opinions on what denuclearization means, when it needs to be put in place, whether it's a precondition for other assistance and other diplomatic actions with the North. And Mr. Bolton's comments are indicative of one set of opinions about a formula that he feels must be put in place before serious discussions with North Korea can take place. Unfortunately, the president seems to be signaling something else. And so inevitably, there is going to be confusion and mixed signals that are going out from Washington towards Pyongyang. And I don't think we should overlook the possibility that there are some mixed signals coming from Pyongyang, too. We don't know. One of the dealing with North Korea, exactly who's pulling the strings, is difficult to tell. But I think we have to work from the assumption that there are people with different views there as well. And there have been people in their military, in part of the party, who for their entire lives have built their careers and their expectations for their country around ongoing confrontation with the United States and have seen the nuclear weapons program as the ultimate way for regime survival. Some of the positive things that Kim Jong-un has been saying clearly did not fit well with everyone in his system. Now, how you interpret an American-South Korean military exercise, was it something from the past that was history and we move into a new era, or is it something that complicates the current moment? Those cheery thoughts of Kim Jong-un are not necessarily shared by those who see this as an opportunity to throw a couple of bricks in the road.
Do you expect to see this process go forward?
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm skeptical about where this is going. Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays looks a little bit better. I think on balance that the presidents and the senior leaders are sufficiently committed that they will do everything they can to overcome these obstacles and get that meeting between Trump and Kim in place in June in Singapore. I'm optimistic that meeting can happen. What happens after that, how far these divisions, internal divisions, uncertainties, lack of trust, historical analogies that are being brought in, and when in the U.S. the Congress gets more involved in other players, then I think the game is multiplied by 100 in complexity. And heaven help the diplomats that want this to move forward.
Dr. Paul Evans, professor of Asian and Trans-Pacific Affairs at the University of British Columbia. He spoke with us from Vancouver via Skype. National Security Advisor John Bolton said last Friday that complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of North Korea is what is needed to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. In a wide-ranging interview with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren, former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Bolton says he does not expect a lengthy negotiation with Kim and that North Korea is coming to the table now because Pyongyang has never seen the level of economic and political pressure that's been put on them by U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign. We hear an excerpt from the interview.
Well, I think President Trump in his campaign said his objective was to put American national interest first. And I think that's been the hallmark of his first year plus in office. He has inherited a lot of problems, Iran, North Korea, the Middle East, that really were either not addressed or were addressed incorrectly in the Obama administration. And that's a big part of his responsibility. The Bush administration, by contrast, came in with this idea that the world's problems had been solved, the Cold War was over, economic growth was the only issue, and then we hit 9/11. So really, his presidency was very different. But I think President Trump's got a series of problems to resolve, and he's systematically working his way through them.
What's sort of interesting, because if you look back historically, like North Korea, for instance, back in the beginning, President Clinton tried to do something, and successive presidents did, and even moving the embassy in Israel, which has been a promise by the U.S. Congress in 1995, President George W. Bush said he was going to do it, President Obama said he was going to do it, and now apparently it is going to be done.
Yeah. Well, this goes to the credibility of the United States, and particularly the President of the United States. So when President Trump says, like every other former successful presidential candidate, I plan to move the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and then he does it, that's not simply something that has an effect on the conditions in Israel, but it says to world leaders all around the world, when he says he's going to do something, he does. And I think, likewise, his recent decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, which he talked about all the time during the campaign and made clear even after he became president, he thought was a terrible deal. By his withdrawal, he simply carried through on what he's been saying consistently for close to 2 years.
What do you expect? Do you expect Iran to come back to the table and negotiate, or is this a standoff between the United States and Iran?
Oh, I don't think it'll be a standoff. I think inevitably as U.S. sanctions kick in, it'll have an effect on Europe. I think their trade and investment with Iran will drop as well. And I think Iran then faces a very difficult choice. They'd love to keep the deal going because of the economic benefits, which all pointed in their direction. But those benefits are about to be cut off. The economy's in much more difficult shape. Even after the release of the sanctions, we saw demonstrations all around the country at the end of last year. So I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Iran to sustain this.
What's the position about regime change in Iran?
Well, that's not the objective of the administration. The objective is to prevent them from coming anywhere close to nuclear weapons. And I think as the economic benefits that Obama conferred on Iran in the deal disappear, that's the point where they say, as the North Koreans may well have said, we just can't bear this, where the cost of the nuclear weapons, in effect, is much too great.
What is the reason that the president got out of the Iran deal? I mean, the IAEA said that, Iran was in compliance. There was a discussion about whether or not the money from the unfreezed assets, that the money that belonged to Iran that was returned during the Obama administration, that provided a lot of money, and that money has been distributed, and there's a lot of complaints it's distributed to Hezbollah and in Yemen and in Syria to fight Israel. Is that the reason why he got out of the deal?
Well, it's certainly the case, the way Obama negotiated the deal, that front-end benefits went to Iran. And that was one of the fundamental mistakes of it. But at its core, the deal was simply not in America's strategic interest. It did not effectively restrain Iran from continuing to pursue deliverable nuclear weapons. It did not have effective verification mechanisms. We entered the deal without knowing anything other than what our own intelligence had given us on Iran's military program. And the IAEA simply didn't have adequate provisions for inspection. So we know that at the core of the deal was a lie about Iran's military aspirations. And the recent information revealed by Israel only underscores that.
But isn't a deal, number one? And I realize that there's a lie underlined, and that's what Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israeli intelligence came up with. But isn't a deal, and doesn't that somehow inhibit the United States in making a deal with Kim Jong-un in North Korea?
Well, I don't think any deal that's based on fraud is valid. And so I think that undercuts it to begin with. But it's also the case a president has to look at the strategic interest of the United States. So when George W. Bush withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, it wasn't because Russia was violating it, although it probably was. It was because the world had changed. And I think in the case of the Iran deal, it was never in America's interest, and it wasn't getting any better with age. I actually think it increases the chances of a deal with North Korea, because North Korea will say to itself, we're obviously not going to get a deal so favorable to us as Iran, and if we want any deal at all, it's going to have to be much more on the U.S. terms.
All right, so who made the first gesture, the United States to North Korea to Kim Jong-un, or Kim Jong-un to the United States to having this summit?
Well, you know, as President Trump says, what exactly has he given up so far? The fact is that President Clinton wanted to go to North Korea at the end of his administration. He couldn't quite work it. And other presidents have thought about it as well. We'll see, I think, very quickly. I really think President Trump is clear-eyed about the prospects here. He's optimistic because he'd like to make a deal, but I don't think we're going to get taken in like prior administrations.
You can see VOA contributor Van Susteren's interview with National Security Advisor John Bolton at voanews.com. Malaysian police raided the home of the former Prime Minister Najib Razak, reportedly searching for documents as part of a renewed probe into a corruption scandal involving a state investment fund. More than a dozen police vehicles were seen at Najib's house shortly after he returned home from prayers at a nearby mosque late Wednesday. Najib has virtually been under house arrest since he lost the general election last week. Police have limited access to his road, and the former leader and his wife are forbidden to leave the country. The jailed Malaysian politician Anwar Ibrahim is a free man after being granted a full pardon Wednesday following last week's dramatic electoral surprise, May 9th, that brought a 92-year-old Mahathir Mohamad out of retirement to become prime minister. Anwar had been serving a 5-year term for sodomy. He said the charge was politically motivated by the just-defeated government of Najib Razak.
In my case, we appealed because there was a miscarriage of justice. We appeal because there was travesty of justice. We appeal because there was clear conspiracy to condemn me, assassinate my political character. Now, there is a new dawn for Malaysia. I must thank the people of Malaysia, regardless of race and religion, who stood by the principles of democracy and freedom. They demand change, and it is our duty now to ensure that this mandate given to Pakatan Harapan would honor this commitment.
The question now is, what role will Anwar play? Amid speculation, he's angling to replace Mr. Mahathir as prime minister. Longtime Malaysia watcher Clive Kessler, professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales, told VOA's Victor Beatty the full pardon means Anwar will not have to wait 5 years to re-enter politics.
He will be eager to contest a by-election to get into the House of Parliament. He will be eager, I imagine, to take over from Dr. Mahathir, while Dr. Mahathir, I think, was looking forward to having a year or two until Anwar was ready to take over. So there could be a bit of tension between the two of them. Anwar's own family said that he probably would need and was looking forward to a bit of a rest to recuperate physically and otherwise. There's also a sense that to get the new government established, Dr. Mahathir carries more authority, is less polarizing, and is a surer hand on the levers of power to establish the new regime. Anwar is a little bit more polarizing, but Anwar's own followers will be very, very eager to get him in the top job sooner rather than later. But there are those who express a certain preference for Dr. Mahathir on the grounds that although Dr. Mahathir is an old authoritarian, Dr. Mahathir is, in religious terms, an Islamic Protestant. He believes in the supremacy of the religious conscience of every individual and really detests the old ulama religious establishment, whereas Anwar, some people fear, is more of a soft Islamist who will be more amenable to influence from stronger, more hardline Islamist influences.
Well, what makes this story so fascinating is that these two, Mahathir and Anwar, are old political rivals.
They were old friends, they were old rivals, but there's something quintessentially Malay about this, that you can fight to the death, but then suddenly it means nothing. They decide it's over, and they somehow or other they write it off.
We are happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. Last week, a Chinese court sentenced former high-ranking Communist Party official Sun Jianzai to life in prison for corruption. Sun, the latest victim of a years-long anti-corruption drive by President Xi Jinping, admitted last month to a court of taking bribes of more than $27 million. He expressed repentance and said he would not appeal. The 54-year-old Sun was removed from his post as party chief of the city of Chongqing last July. He was one of the youngest of 25 members of the country's decision-making Politburo and a top contender for a leadership role. Prosecutors said his guilt extended back 15 years as Minister of Agriculture. Jean-Pierre Cabestan, a professor of government and international relations at Hong Kong Baptist University, told VOA's Victor Beatty Sun was elevated to leader of Chongqing in 2012, just after the 18th Party Congress and Xi Jinping took over the presidency.
He was sort of groomed and promoted by former leaders of the Politburo, like Wen Jiabao, the former prime minister, and Jia Qingling, another heavyweight before 2012. And he was one of the two members of the Politburo, which, you know, belonged to the sixth generation. You mentioned he's 64 years old. He could have succeeded to either Xi Jinping or Prime Minister Li Keqiang by 2022, but now he's out of the race. Now, the reasons behind his fall are multiple. I think there's a clear case for corruption. But there are a lot of ironies because he was promoted after the 18th Party Congress and with Xi Jinping's approval to Chongqing. If the party wanted to know more about him, it could know more about what Xu Zhongzai did in Qijing, in Beijing. I think at the time it was protected by high-level leaders. So it gives you an idea of, you know, how corruption cases are made and why they are made.
Is this case and all of these cases really about graft, or is it more about Xi Jinping putting people he wants in power?
I think it's more the latter, I would say. I mean, the Xu Zhongzai case is a very political case. Again, I think the party could have screened his candidacy when he was promoted to the Politburo, but he was with Hu Chunhua, the other guy who has remained in the Politburo, one of the two members of the sixth generation of the party, and that was the idea. It was to sort of perpetuate a new pattern of succession, which was to, you know, to groom leaders and then give them a chance to become top leaders 10 years later. Now, there's another accusation which has not been mentioned by the court, the accusation which was published in October last year by the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong, according to which Sun Jianzai was accused of vote rigging within the party Central Committee. He's not the only one accused of vote rigging. Deposed leaders, the security czar, Zhou Yongkang, or Lin Jihua was a very close aide to Hu Jintao, his chief of staff, actually, were also accused of vote rigging at the time. And that's why at the 90s Party Congress, Xi Jinping decided to stop establishing a list of candidates submitted for the Politburo positions and standing committee of the Politburo position submitted to the Standing Committee, because he thought that that would allow vote rigging and also the use of Guanxi, you know, connections in order to influence the decision of Standing Committee members in their vote. Clearly, there's a political dimension here which has been sort of somewhat overlooked by the court, but on purpose. I think Xi Jinping wants to portray that case as a clear corruption case, which I think was not. It's more a political battle between the supporter of Xi Jinping and the supporter of former Party General Secretary Hu Jintao or former Premier Wen Jiabao. That's how party leaders settle the account and solve their disputes.
Jean-Pierre Cabestan said while there have been a number of high-profile corruption cases adjudicated in China's courts, most of the thousands being investigated do not reach that level. He said, for the most part, party members caught up in the anti-graft drive are disciplined. We are very happy you are with us here on VOA Asia Weekend. An island located almost 2,000 kilometers southeast of Tokyo holds enough terbium, yttrium, europium, and dysprosium to satisfy world demand for hundreds of years. That is the gist of a recent study in which Japanese researchers claim the mud on the seabed near the island belonging to Japan could very well contain a near-infinite source of certain rare earth elements. Rare earths are elements with unique and often desirable properties. Companies that use rare earths in their products began looking at alternative materials after China, the world's largest producer by a wide margin, introduced export quotas in 2012. However, not every expert believes the expectations, and some say the headlines surrounding the release are overstated. I spoke about that with Alex King, the director of the Critical Materials Institute at the U.S.-run Ames Laboratory in Ames, Iowa.
It's an interesting find. It's not actually new news in some sense. The discovery was announced some years ago, well, 2011. The initial discovery of rare earths on the ocean floor near this island, Minami Torishima. What happened a few weeks ago is an update of the report in a highly prestigious scientific journal called Scientific Reports. So it's kind of exciting, but there's also some interest in what is not said in all the reports. What is there is, you know, that there's a lot of rare earths down there, could meet all of our needs, all of the world's needs for some of the rare earths for hundreds of years in some cases. What you have to sort of read in between the lines is the things that are not said. The biggest use of any single rare earth is probably for neodymium, which is used, it's the bulk of the rare earths used in magnets. And that is one of the elements that's not found there at the bottom of the ocean near Minami Torishima. The place we really need neodymium is anything that relates to magnets, particularly high-power magnets, high-efficiency magnetically-based devices like motors and generators, the earbuds in your, you know, attached to your smartphone, or in fact the speakers in your smartphone, the microphone in your smartphone, and wind turbines, which are very large.
Does this make this island as commercially viable as it seems to be in the initial reports that I read?
I think it has great commercial viability. I don't think it does all the other things that are being suggested, including the claim that it will, I think in one publication I read, it said it will break the Chinese hegemony over minerals. I don't think so, because China has the advantage of having a mine that's been in operation a long time, and for which the cost of operation has been carefully minimized over that time.
Alex King, the director of the Critical Materials Institute at the U.S.-run Ames Laboratory in Ames, Iowa. There is a push to level the playing field for women in India, a country where women account for 42% of new university graduates, but where only 24% are hired as entry-level professionals. Of these, only 19% are likely to achieve senior-level management positions. To make matters worse, the number of women who eventually leave the workforce is also higher than men. As Ritul Joshi reports, a specially designed management course for women in New Delhi is teaching them to make their way in a male-dominated workforce.
Young women are not just taking a management training course. They are learning the skills needed to become senior-level managers, a category dominated by men.
Possibly women don't work.
Helping them is New Delhi's Vedika Scholars Program for Women. Launched in 2015, the program is designed to address the needs and challenges of women professionals.
The attributes which are traditionally considered to be women's strengths, like empathy, collaborative work, are not given due importance right now. There are a lot of modules in our program which help women discover their strengths.
In their daily lives, they're anyway interacting with men. It's just that in the classroom, they're isolated from that, and now thinking through, what does that interaction mean to their lives?
Women very cleverly took that article.
The 18-month program familiarizes students with the principles of management from a woman's perspective. Liberal arts and gender studies are an important part of the curriculum.
Rehen-sehen, livelihoods, resources.
A woman's life, her livelihood, lifestyle, even the violence she faces, she carries it all with her when she enters the workforce. If you can't find a solution to these issues, then it doesn't mean much, even if you are earning well.
So, aap chahe achhi tanha kama rahi hain.
They just sensitize you more to, what your lineage has been as a woman. And when you go into the workforce, it becomes your responsibility to educate people.
Liberal arts broaden your thinking. What follows is that you stop looking at problems only from a business angle. This really changes the way you approach a problem.
Instead of a regular internship, the course offers a unique hands-on approach. The Shadow a CEO program gives students an opportunity to work with a woman chief executive officer for a month, a concept that was borrowed from the Emerging Women Leaders program, jointly run by the U.S. State Department and Fortune magazine.
When I attended that program, it completely changed my views on the challenges faced by women, what would help them, and what are some of the things you should know.
A World Bank report says women entrepreneurs tend to generate more work opportunities for other women. So courses like these can be an effective step towards creating more women entrepreneurs in India. Ritul Joshi for VOA News, New Delhi, India.
The Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon never found the Fountain of Youth, a magical water source supposedly capable of reversing the aging process. But scientists at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, are working to extend human lifespan and delay the onset of multiple age-related diseases and disabilities. More now from VOA's Maya Kay.
Old age typically brings with it health problems, chronic diseases, frailty, and loss of independence. As the world population ages, the aging process poses a challenge for healthcare systems in many countries, according to Tamara Chonia, one of the lead scientists at Mayo Clinic's Robert and Arlene Cogut Center on Aging.
In the United States, for instance, 80% of healthcare cost is basically related to age-related diseases. And aging is the highest risk factor of a lot of diseases and comorbidities.
But Mayo Clinic scientists believe it may be possible to delay age-related diseases by modulating fundamental aging mechanisms.
So the view in the aging field is why not go for a root cause, which is fundamental aging processes themselves, to try to delay the onset of these disorders as a group and to increase what we call health span, the period during life when people are independent, free of pain, free of disability, and enjoy life. How do we add life to years, not necessarily years to life?
It was at Mayo's Center on Aging where senolytic drugs were discovered, agents that selectively eliminate senescent cells that are responsible for aging processes without damaging healthy ones. Basically, these drugs have a potential to slow aging by killing bad cells which accumulate with aging and cause a range of age and disease-related problems. Human studies are next. Senolytic drugs will be given to people with illnesses directly related to the aging process.
We're finding that different combinations of these drugs are effective in different situations. So there's a lot of work to be done in figuring out what the right combinations of these drugs will be for particular human conditions.
If senolytic drugs manage to reduce the health impact of aging and have minimal side effects, then scientists plan to gradually move from treating the consequences of aging to preventing it altogether.
There is a hope maybe we can get positive results, and if it's true, it might revolutionize medicine.
Until then, several additional studies need to be done to determine the safety and efficacy of these drugs. Maya Kay for VOA News, Rochester, Minnesota.
You are listening to VOA Asia Weekend. No matter where they live, young people are capable of coming up with fresh ideas about how to improve life in their communities. At a recently held exhibition in the sprawling Zaatari refugee camp in northern Jordan, teenage Syrians showcased inventions geared toward making refugee camps more livable. VOA's George Putich shared their ideas.
Life in a refugee camp is hard, with all kinds of shortages, from food and water to energy and transport. Humanitarian organizations do what they can, but resources are often limited. UNICEF partnered with the One Foundation, organizes workshops to teach young people various skills and to promote entrepreneurship. UNICEF innovation specialist Robin Louis says they encourage students to look around, identify problems, come up with solutions, and maybe turn them into marketable products.
So, for example, they go into the community and they say, well, there's not enough lighting. They come back to the lab, work with the facilitators, build the lights, go back to the community, test the lights with the community. They'll give them feedback and then improve it.
That is how 15-year-old refugee Dina Askar designed a simple and affordable battery lamp.
There is no electricity between 5 p.m. until 3 a.m., but students need light to study, and with many newborns, mothers need light to take care of their babies. The costs of this invention are very cheap.
Sawan Harb, who uses a wheelchair, redesigned a two-wheeled electric bike to improve his mobility. He shared the challenges of his project with visitors.
I asked for help from someone who works in blacksmithing, and I explained to him the new design with three wheels to be able to climb on it from a wheelchair.
UNICEF representative Robert Jenkins says this is just the start of a process they hope to expand to other refugee camps in Jordan.
We think it has enormous potential to scale up, and obviously we are in need of additional funding in order to realize its full potential, which would be scaling up across the kingdom. So youth in all communities would have an opportunity to go through this process and in the end realize their innovative ideas.
For the less tech-savvy in the camp, workshops also covered sewing and decorative crafts. George Putich, VOA News.
Key U.S. lawmakers Monday attacked President Donald Trump's call to help save jobs at the Chinese technology giant ZTE, contending it overlooks American national security concerns. Senator Marco Rubio, one of Trump's former rivals for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016, said on Twitter the problem with ZTE isn't jobs and trade, it's national security and espionage. The Florida lawmaker added, I hope this isn't the beginning of backing down to China. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden questioned the timing of Trump's call to help ZTE get back into business fast after a U.S. trade ruling severely crippled the company and ordered the U.S. Commerce Department to get it done. Trump said Sunday he is working with Chinese President Xi Jinping to ease the economic fortunes of ZTE, which employs about 80,000 workers and is China's second largest maker of telecommunications equipment. For its part, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Chang said Monday that China greatly appreciates the positive U.S. position on the ZTE issue. President Trump tweeted, ZTE, the large Chinese phone company, buys a big percentage of individual parts from U.S. companies. This is also reflective of the larger trade deal we are negotiating with China and my personal relationship with President Xi. ZTE halted manufacturing at its Shenzhen factory after the Commerce Department blocked access to American-made components until 2025, contending that ZTE had failed to punish its workers for violating U.S. trade controls against North Korea and Iran. Douglas Jacobson is an export and sanctions attorney who represents suppliers that do business with ZTE. I asked Jacobson his reaction to the U.S. president's tweet.
Well, this has caught all of those in the export controls and sanctions world certainly by surprise, and with some degree of shock and awe. This is unprecedented that the president of the United States would intervene in what really is a law enforcement case.
Well, isn't there another side to that story in that this company had apparently done things to, for want of a better term, hurt the U.S. economically as far as the way it has done business?
ZTE was actually caught red-handed by acquiring U.S. products, using those in their devices manufactured in China, and then they were sold to embargoed countries by the United States, including Iran, North Korea, et cetera. And so they were caught by the United States. There were the Bureau of Industry and Security of the Commerce Department issued documents that they had actually found in ZTE's possession, indicating this scheme to violate U.S. sanctions. And ultimately, ZTE was placed 2 years ago on a denial order, and that was temporarily gave a temporary reprieve. And ultimately, the company settled in March of 2017, for they pled guilty to violating U.S. export controls and sanctions laws, and also had to pay a total penalty of nearly $1.2 billion. The latest salvo was in mid-April, so only 4 weeks ago, where the Commerce Department denied ZTE's export privileges because BIS alleged that ZTE did not abide by their end of the settlement agreement. So BIS invoked the denial order, which is the harshest penalty under U.S. law, and as a result, U.S. companies could no longer sell U.S. origin items to ZTE. And as a result, ZTE, since they were so dependent on U.S. software and hardware, they have stated recently that they really cannot continue to do business. And as a result, they've been trying to appeal this case to the Commerce Department. And ultimately, as we've seen by today's tweet, this certainly has gotten the attention of senior political leaders in China and in the United States, and that's led to President Trump's tweet earlier this morning.
Do you think this is signaling a thaw in trade relations between the United States and China?
No, I think this is an independent case that really has to be looked at on its own. And I think this really is delinked from all of the other trade-related issues on the tariffs, on the aluminum, on steel, and on intellectual property. On March 7th, 2017, Secretary of Commerce Ross said in a press release that this investigation and this unprecedented penalty reflects ZTE's egregious scheme to evade U.S. law and systematically mislead investigators. So for them to now do a 180 on that tough talk, I think really indicates the president Trump's willingness to perhaps make a concession to China in exchange perhaps for China's assistance with the North Korea situation and to make concessions perhaps in other trade areas. But generally speaking, this is a unique case to ZTE, and I think that's probably it's certainly unprecedented in that regard.
And has made you a happy man today.
I think my clients, if this proceeds, I think that they certainly will be pleased. And I think it obviously makes ZTE happiest of all. I think that the parties that are going to be unhappy, however, is U.S. law enforcement. I think that U.S. law enforcement, I think that this is going to be the real interesting fallout of how U.S. law enforcement, who has been taking a very hard line on ZTE and other companies who violate U.S. export controls and sanctions, how they are going to react given that the president basically going over their heads and intervening in really what's essentially a law enforcement case.
Douglas Jacobson, an export and sanctions attorney who represents suppliers that do business with ZTE. Stay with us as we continue on BOA Asia Weekend. Indonesia is stepping up security in the world's largest Muslim nation after a series of suicide attacks involving members of two families in the country's second largest city, Surabaya, in East Java. Monday, four members of one family riding on two motorbikes died after they detonated explosives outside police headquarters, wounding several police and passersby. Sunday, a family of six, including two girls aged 9 and 12, died in separate attacks on three Christian churches, killing at least 13 other people and wounding dozens. That attack was claimed by the Islamic State-inspired group JAD. Another three members of one family died and two wounded when a bomb exploded Sunday in an apartment complex near the city. President Joko Widodo condemned the attacks. Greg Feely is an associate professor at the Australian National University who specializes in Islam, politics, and terrorism in Indonesia. Following Sunday's church attacks, he told BOA's Victor Beatty, such incidents involving families is unprecedented in Indonesian jihadism.
I'm not aware of any other cases globally quite like this. We've had brothers, adult brothers and the like, that have undertaken suicide bombings together, but not entire families.
Is there an uptick in jihadism in Indonesia?
Not particularly, in fact. There's certainly quite a few thousand supporters of the Islamic State, of ISIS, in Indonesia. But they have been, until now, very well contained by the Indonesian police. The Indonesian police have a very effective counter-terrorism policing operation, and they have arrested well over 1,000 people in the last 15, 16 years, and successfully prosecuted many of those people for terrorism offences. And almost every day they are uncovering new cells, new operations, arresting people. So they have done remarkably well. But nonetheless, we unfortunately know that they can't catch everyone. And in this particular case, the family seem to have quite successfully evaded detection. And the father was the head of a local branch of a pro-ISIS organization called JAD, but he had no terrorism convictions. The police knew that he'd been to Syria, but had been deported. He and his family had been there, but they hadn't been able to charge him on it because in Indonesia, being a foreign fighter is not an offense.
President Joko Widodo was quick to visit the scene of the attacks. He said this act is barbaric and beyond the limits of humanity, causing victims among members of society, the police, and even innocent children.
The revulsion that he expressed at the nature of this attack, I think, is shared very widely across Indonesian society. Even very conservative Islamic organizations are coming out and condemning this attack with strong language. The very notion that parents could sacrifice their own children in this way is utterly repugnant to most Indonesians. And so it's hard to imagine that this is anything other than an extremely counterproductive jihadist action by this family, whether they thought of things in strategic terms. But usually terrorists will try to not kill fellow Muslims, they'll try to kill people who are non-Muslims or people who are working for the state. But in this particular case, to kill your own family members, that's something that most people are utterly repulsed by.
Greg Feely said that these incidents represent a spike in jihadist attacks in the country not seen since January of 2016, when militants launched a bombing and shooting spree in Jakarta that left 8 people dead, including 5 attackers, and more than 20 wounded. 7 people were found dead over the weekend at a farm in Western Australia. It's reported to be the nation's worst mass shooting for more than 20 years. Phil Mercer reported from Sydney about the unusual news that came as a shock to most Australians.
The bodies of 4 children and 3 adults were discovered Friday in the town of Osmington in Western Australia, 280 kilometres south of Perth, the state capital. This type of gun violence is rare in Australia. Media reports say the killings are the worst mass shootings since the Port Arthur massacre on the island state of Tasmania in 1996. In Port Arthur, 35 people were shot dead by a lone gunman, Martin Bryant, who remains in prison. The shootings led to a comprehensive overhaul of Australia's gun laws, which drastically cut gun-related crime. The measures banned automatic and semi-automatic weapons. The reasons behind Friday's tragedy may never be known. 2 firearms were found at the scene, which is still being pored over by forensic examiners. A murder-suicide is suspected, although this hasn't been confirmed by law enforcement officials. 3 generations of the same family were among the victims. Katrina Miles was found dead alongside her 4 children, aged 8, 10, 12 and 13, and her 58-year-old mother, Cinder. The body of an older man was slumped in a chair on the veranda outside. Nearby Margaret River is a popular surfing town, and many locals have expressed their horror at the deaths. The president of the local shire, Pamela Townsend, says the deaths have shocked residents.
It's such a small community and it will have a huge effect, is already having a huge effect. Because in this community we're so well connected.
Mark McGowan, the state premier of Western Australia, has also reacted to the tragedy.
4 young children, a mother and a grandmother being killed in this way is just a terribly distressing and sad thing. And I think we all feel it keenly.
Phil Mercer for VOA News. Sydney.
As we continue on VOA Asia Weekend, divided opinions on a potential Nobel Peace Prize candidate.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
The Nobel Peace Prize is awarded each year to a person or group that has done the most or the best work for fraternity between nations. Since it was first awarded in 1901, it's been presented to social activists like Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela. Now a group of U.S. House Republicans has nominated Donald Trump for the Peace Prize. The suggestion has prompted both cheers and criticism. Andre Zarkak has the story with Anna Rice narrating.
That's very nice. Nobel. I just want to get the job done.
A number of House Republicans nominated President Trump for the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for trying to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in supported the idea.
Well, I just think that President Moon was very nice when he suggested it. I want to get peace. The main thing, we want to get peace.
Trump critics questioned his desire for peace, pointing out that President Trump has called for an increase in military spending and in America's nuclear arsenal, and saying that he does not rule out the possibility of using force against North Korea. But supporters like Republican Senator Lindsey Graham say the prize would recognize the new potential for peace he has created. For many, that if is a big one. A permanent peace deal on the Korean Peninsula is far from assured. And though the two sides have agreed to meet, nothing is certain. President Trump himself said numerous times that if upcoming talks aren't fruitful, he will, in his words, respectfully leave the meeting. But the lack of a definitive peace deal has not deterred the Nobel Committee in the past. The Vietnam War had not ended when Le Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger were awarded the prize. Yasser Arafat, who shared the prize with Israeli leaders Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres for efforts towards Middle East peace, was quoted saying, "We shall never stop until we can go back home and Israel is destroyed." And one does not need to be a peacemaker to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. That list includes Juan Perón, 3 times president of Argentina, who restricted civil liberties, Italian fascist ruler Benito Mussolini, and even Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, who executed hundreds of thousands of his own people. The 2018 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize will be announced in October. Anna Rice for Andrei Dzerkach for VOA News, Washington.
A new approach for detecting food poisoning is being used to investigate the recent outbreak of E. coli bacteria in romaine lettuce grown in the U.S. state of Arizona. The tainted produce has sickened at least 84 people in 19 states. The new method used by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention relies on genetic sequencing. And as VOA's Faiza Al-Masri tells us in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus, it has the potential to revolutionize the detection of food poisoning outbreaks.
Lauren Bush has firsthand experience with food poisoning. Over a decade ago, she got extremely sick after eating a spinach salad. She suffered mysterious flu-like symptoms for 6 months.
I remember turning to my parents and saying, I'm really scared. I mean, do you think I could die before they figure out what it is?
Finally, doctors discovered the source of her distress, E. coli bacteria in the spinach. Bush's experience is not uncommon. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, around 48 million Americans get sick and 3,000 die from food poisoning every year. The new genetic technique is helping scientists connect the dots in seemingly unrelated outbreaks of foodborne illnesses. Comparing whole genome sequencing on DNA samples from different people who've become ill allows them to see if the bacteria are the same strain and how resistant they are to current medicine. Initially, health workers sent samples to the CDC, but now all 50 states are getting money to help them set up their own labs. It speeds up the analysis.
It takes about 40 hours to sequence, and you probably have 8 hours of prep time before going on the instrument. And then once you have the sequence information off the sequencer, it's kind of like having a shredded paper document. So we have to use computational biology techniques to piece the genome back together, and that'll usually take a few hours. So all in all, the process from start to finish can be achieved in less than 72 hours.
While initially focused on Listeria, the technique was effective for identifying E. coli strains.
So for the current romaine outbreak, we have been able to get some sequencing results back. We can see that the bacteria in that outbreak are very closely related to one another.
By the end of the year, labs expect to use this technique for other common causes of food poisoning. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Silicon Valley, the U.S. hub of technology, is getting so expensive that tech workers are struggling to get by, and startup companies are questioning whether to locate there. One city, thousands of kilometers away, is ready to welcome tech companies with an experienced workforce in hopes of becoming the next Silicon Valley. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti takes us to the city, which has a new tech university that could be replicated anywhere in the world.
Let's start with the numbers. Technology companies here pump $7.7 billion into the city's economy and hire 75,000 people. Job postings for emerging tech are up 40% over last year, and unemployment is only 3%. No, this isn't Silicon Valley. It's Middle America, Indianapolis, Indiana.
It's on the cusp of what we're seeing as being sort of a tech boom.
So Courtney Spence founded Kenzie Academy. It's a coding university to attract startups to America's heartland and to supply them with trained software developers.
So we know when it's entirely full,
and we know when it's entirely empty.
Steve Hirschberger is hiring local Kenzie interns for his beer management system, rather than flying in coders and engineers from Silicon Valley.
The big universities used to train for that. They don't train for it today.
Through these local business partnerships, students learn outside the classroom. Maya Williams will graduate in December of 2019 as part of Kenzie's first class. She moved to Indianapolis from Louisiana to study medical software engineering.
New Orleans is very healthcare-based, but their technology was lacking somewhat, and there wasn't really a job market out there for that.
Kenzie actively recruits females in what has traditionally been a male-dominated industry. But in the next class, just 3 out of 12 are women.
Graphics look very old.
Student Kavita Kamobabu says women need more confidence in their tech skills.
You have to, like, brush off all those fears and be ready to face anything. That's how you can win. That's how you can build a career.
Kamo Baubul and half her class aren't paying Kenzie's $12,000 a year tuition. Well, not right now. Instead, a school program allows them to pay part of their first job salary for the tuition.
I will be visiting a tech company in India.
Kenzie might be a success for Indianapolis, but at Stanford University, located in the heart of Silicon Valley, students are skeptical.
When I think of high tech, I usually think of places like the Bay Area, Los Angeles, New York, but not somewhere like Indianapolis.
If not Indiana, how about Asia? Kenzie founders plan to duplicate the academy model starting in Malaysia. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News, Indianapolis, Indiana.
As U.S. farmers head to their fields to plant this year's crop, they face new challenges created by Chinese threats to impose tariffs on some of their products. It is the latest salvo in an escalating trade dispute that has farmers warily watching fluctuating commodity prices as the United States Department of Agriculture projects net farm income in 2018 to reach a 12-year low. VOA's Kane Farabaugh had more from Illinois.
Farmer Scott Halpin is entering another year of high prices for seed and fertilizer. And low prices for the corn and soybeans his family is planting on farmland outside Morris, Illinois.
The equipment's expensive, land's expensive, and it costs a lot of money to put the crop in the ground.
Now there is the threat of Chinese tariffs on U.S. soybeans. A retaliatory move in the wake of pending U.S. tariffs on Chinese aluminum and steel that could further impact Halpin's bottom line.
Soybeans make up about just under half of our crop rotation, and it's a real important part of our farming operation here.
And there are reports that buyers in China, the world's top consumer of soybeans, have stopped purchasing supplies from the U.S. even before tariffs are in place.
It can hurt when things happen on a daily basis, just kind of uncertain times here in farming.
Uncertain but not unbearable, says Phil Flynn, senior market analyst with the Price Futures Group and a contributor to Fox Business News.
Even though China's talking tough, they realize that they cannot get into a trade war with the United States because they have a lot more to lose right now than we do.
According to the USDA, China imports about 63% of the total world export of soybeans and is the second largest export market for U.S. grain products.
The world's changed. There's not a lot of places that can replace American soybeans in the near term. So, and the tariffs are probably not going to be enough to change Chinese purchases, because at the end of the day, there's going to be a time and place where the only place they can get their soybeans that they're going to need desperately in their soybean meal is going to be the United States, even at a higher price.
Scott Halpin says he understands the big picture and the need for fair trade, but farmers could use a little security in tough economic times.
We understand that there's inadequacies in the overall trade, but yeah, it makes us a little uneasy that the soybean market is such a volatile part of the ag economy, and China's such a big player. We need China.
Or someone else to step up and take China's place.
I guess historically we know that the markets should come back and somebody will pick up the slack. If China's buying from another country, somebody else is going to be looking for our soybeans. It would just be nice to have more stability in it.
While the uncertainty isn't changing the Halpin family's overall plans this planting season, it could be a different story during harvest time later this year.
The prices and the markets dramatically affect how we do things on the farm.
So does the weather, the other great uncertainty all farmers face. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Morris, Illinois.
Thank you for joining us on VOA Asia Weekend. To learn about any of these stories, go to our website at voaasia.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful week.